and here we go. WTC episode 24. We talk comics, The Flaming Skulls. On the air and in your ear, I'm Mo underscore We Talk. No E on my name. Mo at We Talk Podcasts. I'm joined, of course, by Brett. Brett, how you doing?
I'm pretty good. And I'm Brett, B-R-E-T-T, underscore We Talk, and Brett at WeTalkPodcast.com.
Keith?
I am doing excellent well, Mo. I am Cub Reporter K on Twitter, and you can email me at Keith at WeTalkPodcast.com when I change your mind about some of the things that you believed up till now.
And Chris?
I'm Chris at WeTalkPodcast.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at Chris underscore WeTalk.
All right.
And I'm not doing very well at all, Mo, but thanks for asking.
Well, you know, I'm not doing too good either because I got a cold given to me by Keith from when we were interviewing Joe Mulvey. So, of course, I hate Keith, but that's not new. So we're going to get onto our regular opening sequence, and Keith is going to rebut my last statement in his news, I'm sure, as we hit the cover or the weekly news with Cub Reporter K.
Well, the big news is that Mo and I both have some kind of cold, or Mo has pneumonia. I have – my doctor thinks I actually have gotten asthma all of a sudden.
Old pneumonia?
So it's been a – yes, I have old pneumonia. Thanks. But I asked my doctor about that, but he didn't.
So I've caught asthma.
That was made up.
Good job. Thanks, Keith.
I caught it. Yes, I've got contagious asthma, as it turns out.
Wow.
So in the news this week, only one lawsuit to report on.
Oh, what an improvement.
It's a slow week.
The Burroughs Foundation, which controls the rights to the later Edgar Rice Burroughs novels of Tarzan, John Carter, etc., have filed suit against Dynamite Comics for their publishing the Lord of the Jungle and Warlord of Mars comic books, among others. Essentially, the characters of John Carter and Tarzan can be used if you're not basing the material on the later books that are still in copyright, because the first few books are in public domain. However, you can't use the names John Carter and Tarzan, which is why these Dynamite Comics don't have that on the cover. I read actually the lawsuit itself, and there's some interesting reading in it. They do specifically mention the risque covers that are a variant the Dynamite does, which are include nude covers and some of the sex scenes that are in one of the series. Essentially, what they're saying is that because there is a real license from the Edgar Rice Burroughs family for comics that is not held by Dynamite, it's held by Dark Horse, these comics are infringing on their trademark, which is different than copyright, as we were talking about last week.
Can I just mention, they have trouble with the risque covers?
Mm-hmm, they do.
So, can you imagine all the problems they have with that Bo Derek Tarzan movie then? It's like 90 minutes long, and it's like 80 minutes of her walking around topless. Horrible movie. I've probably seen it 200 times.
And I didn't check to see if that was an authorized version of Tarzan or not. Is it actually called Tarzan, or is it called Lord of the Apes?
I believe it's... No, Lord of the Apes, I think, is the Christopher Lambert Tarzan.
No, that's Greystoke.
Oh, that's Greystoke. I believe this is... Tarzan the Ape Man is the title of the movie.
All right, so now it probably was authorized then if they used the actual name Tarzan. That seems to be kind of the divider line, your indicator of whether it's authorized
or not. Yes,
I'm
seeing her naked. This was a good decision.
Safe searches off. So we'll see where that goes from here. Anyone been reading those Dynamite comics?
I haven't, but I do want to say Bo Derek's one of my all-time favorite actresses. That woman could act.
We'll be watching that one later for a We Talk Comics review coming up. We'll watch all the Tarzan movies, every Tarzan film. And we'll put together a six-hour version after we finish editing the eight-hour Joe Mulvey interview.
That's just funny to you and me because we were there.
Well, you'll be amazed the magic that comes out of the 90 minutes that we do end up with. So, more news. Justice League #1 has gone to a seventh print.
Holy crap.
Jimmy Palmiotti's The New West, which I haven't read, has been optioned for a film.
Well, who was the publisher of this?
That was published by Black Bull Entertainment. And I don't think any of us have actually read that one.
No, but I would look forward to reading it.
And becoming a fan, that's true. The Earth 2 upcoming DC comic, part of the second wave, New 52, the variant cover has been released to a lot of question marks from fans, but we still haven't seen the primary cover of this book. Now, you guys took a look at this variant cover. Reactions?
Well, I'm actually, my reaction, I'd like to know, first off, Keith, is what's the reaction from the community? Because I didn't really see anything that made me react, personally.
Well, I think the expectation was that Earth 2 would be a Justice Society book. And it's been going on 30 years since we saw a Justice Society that included Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman, that's for sure.
Okay. When you put it like that, my reaction is, why can't it still be a Justice Society book? I mean, just because that has been for the past. I mean, if these are the characters that drive sales, and you can include it in Earth 2 and in Justice Society, along with these Golden Age characters we're familiar with, you want the proper to be as successful as possible. And if these are the characters that will can be added in to allow it to do that, then what's wrong with that?
They got their own books already. I want the Justice Society. I want the real JSA.
Yeah, you're thinking from a fan's perspective, and I'm thinking from a businessman's perspective in this case. And I think, they want to drive the highest sales as possible. And it doesn't mean the stories can't still be good.
What about the idea of adding even one of the JSA characters to the cover, as well as those other characters?
Well, we haven't seen the other cover yet, have we? This is just a variant, though, Brett. We haven't seen the other cover. This is a tease. They're trying to create buzz, and they've successfully done that.
They've gotten buzz, both positive and negative. Certainly those that were going in thinking, yay, finally we've got the Justice Society back. My first reaction was, oh, yay, a ninth book every month with Batman in it. That's exactly what I wanted to buy. Which, yeah, it is a fan's reaction, but I buy as a fan, not as a business fan.
Okay, so you wouldn't, but do you think they're going to lose more potential customers if they have the big three in it than they would gain? I don't think so.
I think my concern is that with the big three, it's really an ongoing Elseworlds book. It's not really saying anything compelling to me that I would
want
to. I hate
to tell you this, but my point of view about every book in comics nowadays is it's an ongoing Elseworlds book. This is what they've created for me. This is the attitude they've created long term.
This has nothing to do with anything other than it's on the cover. Do you guys think the villains here are from Apocalypse?
Yes, that looks like Parademons to me.
Okay, they're just a little different.
Yeah, and what we're hearing, I mean, it's only tease stuff that we've heard about Earth 2 so far, but the phrasing that we've heard is that this is a world that has been at war for a very long time. We do know that Power Girl and the Huntress, who traditionally are second-generation characters, the old Earth 2, Huntress was the daughter of Batman, and was it Catwoman or was it... Batwoman.
I think it was Batwoman, if I remember correctly. I think so, but don't quote me on that.
Helena Wayne, yeah.
Yeah.
And Power Girl, very much the second generation Superman character, or Supergirl, the Supergirl of Earth 2. Yeah, I mean, I think my concern with it is if it's just a Elseworlds version of Justice League, I've already dropped Justice League, so...
But this is James Robinson, correct, writing this?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. I trust his work.
Yeah, you put him on the JLA, I might read it.
Brett said, Brett, did you say you thought you trusted Jeff Johns?
Yep.
Good point. Actually, Brett, that's a fantastic point.
And how many times have we seen, like a cover like that and then have the interior be something like completely, almost radically different?
Again, variant cover.
Yeah, and that's one of the questions is, why are we seeing only the variant cover? It's actually, that's been out for a couple of weeks, but we still haven't seen the primary cover of this book.
And my other question is, if this is the variant cover, why isn't it the risque version? That's what I'd like to see. That one was hot.
Well, one of the rumors that's been floating around is that if you look at the weapon that the Batman character is carrying, it's actually Nightwing's nunchuck-type things. And that's led to some speculation that these are all second-generation characters, so it's actually Dick Grayson as Batman, possibly Donna Troy as Wonder Woman, and then someone else as Superman. And these may actually be where the legacy characters go. And then, by extension, the next step would be Wally West.
Interesting. You know what? For me, like I say, I mean, until it comes out, do you recall what the publication date is of that?
That's out in May.
It's out in May. Okay, so we're still quite a ways away. Interesting.
Yeah, a little bit of time.
All right, any other news?
Yes, indeed. There are continuing rumors that Marvel is going to do some sort of reboot relaunch after AVX. One of the things that they said just recently was that the Avengers vs. X-Men crossover will have long-term real effects on the Marvel Universe.
Like and Civil War?
As opposed to Civil War, I think is what they're getting at.
Okay.
They didn't quite say, as opposed to every event we've done for the past 10 years, this one's actually going to matter.
Yeah. Nice.
But the phrasing is quite curious to think that it will result in a whole new Marvel Universe. So there is a lot of, we're back to the rumors that Marvel will do a reboot or a relaunch of some sort this year.
And I think it's actually wise for them to do so in many, many perspectives. Number one, try and regain some of that market share that they've lost out to DC. And number two, because the continuity in a lot of ways needs a lot of cleaning up and some of the characters just need a refreshing. So I think it's a good idea. Anybody else?
Yeah, get rid of the X-Men, change up Spider-Man. I'm not asking
actually,
for much.
That's true. Let's just publish. Who's your favorite character there from Marvel, Brett?
Spider-Man, Captain America, one of them.
All right, let's just go with Captain America. That's it. That's all they publish. One Captain America book.
Well, that would be easy. At least I would totally follow Marvel then all the time.
It's by Liefeld.
Well, then nobody's reading it.
Yeah, exactly. Then Marvel needs way more help than I can provide.
I just hope they choose to do it in an original manner. If they're just going to ape DC, I think it's a huge mistake.
That's true, actually, and I'm not sure how you can do it without aping DC to some degree.
I guess you relaunch every book at point one.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Well, you could actually try to relaunch every book straight, as opposed to relaunching some of them and then just putting a number one on a continuation of the story.
Actually, I'd like to see a Marvel do a crisis story where they actually go in and revamp.
So, after all, they have at least 616 universes. That's a hell of a lot to clean up.
Well, I didn't say it was a perfect plan.
It is the reintroduction of the Phoenix Force into the Marvel Universe. All bets are off once you bring the Phoenix Force back to Earth.
That's true.
That's true, and they do mention rebirth, you know, the Phoenix Force destroys and then rebirths.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, any other news?
Yeah, one last little bit. Secret Avengers number 27 will feature the return of Captain Marvel.
Which Captain Marvel?
Oh, the one who died in the 1980s.
Fuck them.
Anything more you want to add to that point? I'm just going to read a couple quotes from Rick Remender.
That's my whole point, and I'm going to stick by that.
Rick Remender, who's writing Secret Avengers, has said on his Twitter, "We have huge fun plans for Marvel, lots of surprises on the way, not a Skrull, not an imaginary story." And later wrote, "Third day rewriting Marvel's return. It's a pretty heavy nerd responsibility to get this right."
Yeah, I'll say. And also a heavy responsibility for me to not drop any more F-bombs as we try and keep this as clean as possible. So instead of just saying it again, I'll let somebody else say, but I think you get my point. Nobody else has a reaction?
Another one bites the dust.
None of the three of you have a reaction besides me?
It's probably all the same reaction. It's just, why put more words to it?
Yeah,
I just don't care.
Mine was perfect.
Well, I gotta say, now, Mo, you're the biggest Captain Marvel fan that I know. Out of, there's not actually a legion of them. I'll just say that you're the top one. I take it from your reaction that even you have not been clamoring for the return of this character who's been dead for 30 years.
Well, I'm a fan of the character, yes, but, I mean, we've seen a lot of stuff.
But are you a fan of the character or his death?
Well, that's a part of what I was about to say is you, we're talking about, when we talk about the greatest death stories, that's one that still sticks in is both in quality and in its, and in the fact that it's, it hasn't been screwed with too much. So we have had, I believe, a character come around as the son of Captain Marvel being him. We had a black chick as Captain Marvel at some point, completely unrelated. We've had Ms. Marvel. We've had him come back, but it's him from when he was younger before he died. So they've already screwed with the character and the death in a lot of ways. But I can ignore that stuff because I'll go, okay, he died. It was great. I can ignore it. I don't have to pay attention to it. I don't have to pay attention to Peter David talking about his son being Captain Marvel now, whatever, or writing it. Even if it's good, it doesn't matter to me. I can ignore it. But I can't ignore the actual guy being brought back. Like, this is it's just too much spitting in the face of what they've done right. And sometimes, you know what? You just got to respect when you did something right. You should be happy with that. And instead, they're just going, I don't, you're right. I'm not clamoring for the return of the character. What I'm clamoring for is more great stories with other characters and remembrance of this character. How about that instead? So I'm
saying there. And that's the news.
All right, well, let's move on to our first topic of the week. Now, what we're doing here, as we had mentioned it last week, is our fanboy film review. And the concept here is what we're doing is we're not really looking at the quality of the film, though that does come into play to some degree. Largely what we're trying to do is look at how true to the property was the film adaptation. This week we're talking about the original Ghost Rider, because with the second one having come out and none of us being masochists, only one of us went to see it. But we can certainly talk about the first Ghost Rider film. And I'm going to open this up with Chris, because quite honestly, while I make fun of Chris, there's nobody whose opinions of movies I trust or respect more in this entire planet. So, Chris, though I expect I may argue with you on this, I still do respect your film knowledge. Why don't you open up talking about, from just breaking it down from how respectful of the property or how well did they do it, fanboy film review of the first Ghost Rider film with Nick Cage.
If you broke it down to bullet points, I think they did a fairly good job of actually paying attention to what has gone before. They condensed a lot. But as far as truth to the property, I don't have any problems there. It's really the film that I have problems with.
All right, well, what are the problems with the film?
Oh, I saw this in the theater originally.
I said bullet points, so that's what we're trying to do, so yeah.
I originally saw it in the theater, and I have to say I did not hate it in the theater. But upon rewatching for this podcast, I was left with so many questions. Like, why does Sam Elliott have to ride to the big show off? He just rides and then rides away. And is it possibly the worst casting of a young Nicolas Cage ever? I mean, you could have Samuel Jackson play the young Nicolas Cage, and it would be more realistic than the guy they got.
I thought I'd get an imitation of Nick Cage's voice. You know, Nick Cage, why am I not in this? Why? I'm in everything. You know that?
Okay.
All right, but you really didn't think that they did much with the property, that you didn't think they screwed it up too much?
They condensed a lot.
They changed some stuff.
I liked
it. I'm not sure the changes were necessary.
I think it shortened it up a little bit. I hated the fact that he never actually signed the contract. I hated the fact that he didn't have to seek out the devil like he does in the comic book. The devil just sort of shows up on his doorstep. The whole bit with Roxanne wasn't exactly on. But on a whole, I was just praying for that section of the movie to be done with.
All right, so let's let's break it down here and then this way. Give me out of 10, if you were to rate how good a job they did with the property out of 10, then give me how good a film it is out of 10. Give me two ratings.
Okay. They probably got a 7 for loyalty, but probably a 3 on an actual movie basis.
Chris, or Keith, thanks, Chris. Keith, in response and your thoughts?
Well, anytime you adapt, you've got to kind of pull the best parts and the most recognizable parts out of a character. And Johnny Blaze, you know, he had been around in the 90s as a bit of a retro character because the other Ghost Rider was around at that point, the Danny Ketch Ghost Rider. So I wasn't too familiar with the original. I've read a few pieces here and there. But really knew him more from the 90s, and that's they've left most of that stuff out and tried to go back to the 70s version. I think they did a decent job of hitting the big points, you know, the deal with the devil and the way he gets screwed on the deal anyway, and the tormented soul, all that stuff, and gave him a villain that was worth fighting. I'd actually give him an eight on adaptation. And I'm gonna give the film, though, a 7.
What?
I'm gonna break ranks here. Comic book films for me. One comic book film per character gets a pass from me, because all I needed that film to do was to show me Ghost Rider on his motorcycle with his head on fire. That's all I needed. And I will say this: the Daredevil film. I got what I needed from that film. If there was a second Daredevil film, then I would be changing my ratings. But one superhero film per character gets a pass. So Ghost Rider 1 gets a pass until I see Ghost Rider 2, and then probably still Ghost Rider 1 is the one getting a pass.
Brett, what did you think?
I loved everything about it. Again, I can't get through it. I think any Ghost Rider movie really has to have Mephisto, has to have Blackheart. You know, absolutely. If it has those, then you kind of touched on some of the major characters, the major villains. So that's an excellent choice. I was in San Diego in 2007 going to Comic-Con when I saw this movie. And I remember watching it because I was definitely interested in seeing the movie because, again, I, like Keith, wanted Flaming Skull driving down the highway on Flaming Motorbike. I was totally into that. But the truth of the matter is that Nick Cage dragged me out of that so badly, because he is so horrifically miscast as Johnny Blaze that you may give it an 8, and Chris may give it a 7, but I'm going to give it a 5. Simply because Nick Cage blows.
And that's as a property? Loyalty gear?
That's as a property.
Okay. Yep. And as a film?
Yep. The 5 is entirely due to the fact that they have the villains and the story. Like, the story might be fine, and it would be better if it didn't have Nick Cage, pretty much guaranteed. But as a film, I'm going to give it a 1. Because it sucks. I am the guy who up to this point was very happy to say, I don't care if it's a comic book movie, I want it as part of my collection. I have Reb Brown Captain America in my collection. And I won't have Nick Cage Ghost Rider in my collection. Because that's how bad it is.
Yeah, it's a piece of crap. I've had it for 4 years, and I have not watched it. I've owned it for 4 years, Brett, and I wish I didn't. Not watched it. I've waited until we had to do this podcast to give me the push. Oh, man, I have so much to say. Yeah, Mephisto's in it. Blackheart's in it. But as far as loyalty to the characters, how much like the characters in the books are these guys?
Well, I don't remember them being terribly close. Again, I haven't read too many of the stories. I mean, the Blackheart, it's tough because the Blackheart character is really not that much like the book.
No. No. Now, and you say Nicolas Cage, there's two Nicolas Cages. This Nicolas Cage is either in movies, he's likable or he's annoying. This is one of the annoying performances. The likable ones are a lot less of them, but there are some. But this is a lot of annoying. You're right. He's a terrible Johnny Blaze. I don't see a Johnny Blaze being in his 90s. And I also don't see how he's like 17 years old and he signs this deal with the devil. And then there's his Roxanne Simpson character. And you got, and I'm getting off into the movie instead of into the actual loyalty here, but I don't see how you could have this Roxanne character who's played by Eva Mendes. And then you get them together like 20 years later or whatever, and they're supposed to be the same age, and he's old enough to be her great, 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 great grandfather. Like, stupid. Anyways, and he's,
I did the math. It was 10 years.
What's that?
I did the math. It was 10 years.
Yeah, it's more. I don't care what they say. Don't they say Nick Cage is only like 50? Nah, bullshit. That guy's in his late 70s at least. He's like 2 years older than Sam Elliott, who's playing caretaker in this. I'm guaranteeing it. There's some sort of crazy plastic surgery going, keeping him on, making him look younger than he is, making him look like he's only 60, but he looks at least 60. I don't care. Nick Cage. Oh, how am I not in this? I tell you, you're in everything, and I hate you for it. Now, as far as...
I like Nick Cage.
Yeah, I know you do. Anyways, like I say, I like him in some films, too. Annoying or likable. Keith, you have something you want to say?
I just want to throw in a qualifier that I will give Nicolas Cage's wig a 1 out of 10 for a resemblance to Nicolas Cage's real hairline.
Well, actually, I don't know if anybody saw, but I noted on the internet the other day that there was some sort of crazy thing with Nick Cage being a vampire because there's a photo taken in like the 1870s that looks a lot like Nick Cage does. So you could be right, Mo.
That makes a lot of sense.
I have actually seen Nick Cage in the sunlight.
But even if there's 10 years different, it looks like a lot more. It's just bad. But okay, like I'm going to get on now to the loyalty of the characters. Four things this movie does really, really well. Number one is, and I'll say them in this order, some of the visuals are awesome. Special effects are really terrific. The spider bait version of Riders in the Sky and their end credits is tremendous. And then there's the fourth thing, and that's the actual characterization of Ghost Rider when he's on the screen. The Ghost Rider character, when he's transformed into that, is really, really good and on par with the comics. Now, here's the problem. This movie is like 2 hours and 3 minutes, and I think 3 minutes of that had Ghost Rider on the screen. Like, it's all Nick Cage. It's like, Ghost Rider's barely in this fucking thing. Like, I'm sorry.
And unfortunately, Eva Mendes is in it, too. So.
Oh, her acting is so bad. They're fighting back and forth for worst actor in the world in this film. And she wins. Terrible. 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 So, I mean, that's one of my issues. Is the Ghost Rider character himself, yeah, that's fine when he's on screen. But he's barely in it. Then you have Nicolas Cage, who's he's putting too much Nicolas Cage quirky, like he has to do. Like he's sitting there and the character is drinking Skittles from a glass. Like, that's so Nick Cage, trying to be Nick Cage. That is nothing, like we talk about the character just a little bit. You talk about the storyline and how they adapted it. They actually did a pretty good job. They made a couple changes that I don't think they need to. But as far as adapting the character's actual origin and the storyline, they did a good job of that. But as far as just changing the essence of who Johnny Blaze is for Nicolas Cage to go out and swing his dick like Nicolas Cage, they did too much of that. And that's poor. So I would give this film about a 1.5. I give it a little better in Brett because I do think the special effects were awesome and some of the visuals and that song. But as far as like an adaptation, I'd give it a 4. And you know what? This was voted from IGN worst comic book film of the 2000s. And it's easy to see why. Now, I'll let Chris, because he's the one who took the bullet for the team, and the reviews are managed to be even worse, as did the box office. And what I've seen of the sequel would just piss me off, too. But he's took the bullet for the team. He went and saw the sequel. Chris, quickly, your thoughts as far as, well, those same two reviews. Out of 10 for loyalty and quality for the sequel.
Okay. His hairpiece is better, so I guess I give it a 5 for the actual movie. And loyalty, they they really didn't touch on the origin or anything like that. So I'm probably going to give it a 7 as well, just because Danny is mentioned.
Do they reference him as his brother?
No. Nick Cage is saving a kid whose name is Danny, and they never actually mention his last name.
Okay. And yes, Keith, in case you were wondering, yes, if you missed that reveal, Howard Mackey made that mistake and made Danny Ketch the brother of Johnny Blaze late in his run. And nobody likes that decision.
What utter nonsense.
I'd agree. All right, let's move on to Comic Book Guy. What we're going to talk about next is the Comic Book Guy character, whether or not we think he's a tribute or is he an insult, basically. The Comic Book Guy character from Simpsons. Brett, what are your thoughts?
I'm going to go with tribute. And I think that's really primarily because of the fact that with the Simpsons having been around for 20 years and Comic Book Guy is still a viable part of the show. So I think that it's, even no matter how it started, it's become a tribute in the fact that people just associate that, you know, that kind of Comic Book Guy. And granted, when you see shows like Comic Book Men, it makes Comic Book Guy look pretty true in that regard, even though Comic Book Guy isn't all that true for most of the comic book people that I've met. Maybe size-wise, yes, but you know, not necessarily attitude-wise, but I think that overall it's, if you've met somebody like that in comic books, then the likelihood of it being a tribute is pretty good.
Chris, what do you think?
I've suggested this topic because, quite frankly, I've always been sort of divided on it. I've always been insulted by the Comic Book Guy, yet I laugh my ass off every time he's on the show. I have to say, a lot of what Comic Book Guy does is true to form. I mean, I remember when I was shopping at your guys' store and the Magic Kids would come in, your face sort of changed, and you had a snarky attitude there, guys. I remember some of Keith's co-workers when he was running Comic Book Store, and they had a guy there that looked exactly like the Comic Book Guy. And kind of acted like him.
Wait a second, that guy looked a lot like Keith. In fact, I called that guy the Scarlet Keith, if you'll remember correctly. I didn't know his actual name.
I wasn't actually referring to the Scarlet Keith. I was referring to the older gentleman with the glove.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we won't get into that, but I do know the Comic Book Guy, unfortunately. I exhibit some of the qualities of the Comic Book Guy occasionally giving facts that nobody cares about. Going off on rants that Jar Jar Binks was the worst creation ever. I'm guilty of these things, so I have to say it's probably a tribute, just not one I particularly like.
I'm going to go off here. I do think you exhibit some of those qualities, actually. But
Oh, I know I do. I just don't particularly love those qualities in myself.
You know, not every comic book, like the comic book guy, you have to keep in mind, Simpsons is a show, it's a television show, it's a comedy, right? They're parodying this. Not everybody who watches The Simpsons has ever been a comic book shop, amazingly enough. But I guarantee you there are some parents who have taken their kids to a comic book shop, ran to that guy and went, what a douchebag. Or Mulvey bag, as me and Keith like to call it. I'm going to talk about, Brett said that not a lot of people are like that. And Chris did a good job bringing up the guy from an old store that he had mentioned that was similar to that. Brett, do you remember the store? We had a file there before we had our own called Atomic Comics.
Yes, I do.
Okay. Atomic Comics originally had a guy who was running it who didn't care life or love or no comics at all. He would just order 7,000 issues of Image and about 20 of everything else and put them on the shelves and not even say hello to you. He was like the most antisocial guy. He didn't like comics. Then it was bought out by a guy. Do you remember what this guy looked like, Brett? He looked like Comic Book Guy.
I vaguely remember.
That's what he looked like. He had the ponytail.
Oh, yeah, that's
true. He was balding. He had the little goatee. He dressed the same. He was exactly, like, I swear to God, every time I see this guy, I think it's the guy from Atomic Comics. This guy was such a loser geek, Brett, that you and I would, he owned a comic book store, but his level of geek was so high that we would go in there and make fun of him, because even in his own comic book store, this comic book owner could not be saved from the level of geek he was. There was no safe refuge for this high a level of geek. This is a level of geek that you and I thought was too geeky. And who's geekier than us? This guy was. Remember when we walked in that day and it was like the 20th anniversary of, or 10th anniversary of Star Trek Next Generation's debut, and so he was dressed in his Star Trek suit, and how much we made fun of him? Comic book guy would do this. We just sat there making fun of him in front of all his customers for no reason, because we couldn't believe what a dork he was. This guy looked and sounded just like comic book guy. So yes, this is a tribute. No, it's not kind. It's an insulting tribute. But that doesn't mean it isn't a tribute. Keith, what do you think?
I miss that guy.
What's that?
I miss that guy from Atomic Comics. He was a good guy.
He was a nice guy. Me and Brett were just young kids and jerks. As opposed to now, we're older
and
guys.
Now we're
glad you're older now.
We're older now. We're older jerks now.
I have been in comic stores across this country, across the country next to us. I have seen so many comic book guys. And I think that the character is charming. He's snarky, he's...
superior.
He's superior because he controls his own little world. And I think that's what's fun about comic book guy, is that he is total control over this very small environment. And that's the comic book guy that I see all over the place. Everyone comes in and they all admire the guy that owns his own store, and he gets to just be around comics all day.
Except for when you're assholes like me and Brett.
Well, yeah, those are the kids that you hassle for reading at the shelf and you throw them out. I was a comic book guy. But what I like about this guy is, unlike the gentleman on Comic Book Man, there's nothing mean about the comic book guy character. He's snarky, sarcastic, and references Star Trek episodes relating to every situation. But there's nothing mean about the character. And I don't think there's anything mean in the portrayal of the character. So, and I know a lot of people that work in comic stores that just own that character as their own personal view of themselves. I think that's great.
All right. Comic book character. Seems like everybody generally loves the character and sees him as a tribute, as a general rule. I swear to God, so much of this character is just like this guy. I mean, it was so dead on. It's frightening. All right, we got back into the WeViews, our weekly review section. And this time we're going to do something a little bit different. There's not a lot of new number ones or kind of milestone issues that have come out this week. So what we did is we're kind of trying to clean up a few mini-series that have finished up recently, and I'd like to review the mini-series as well and keep you up to date on those, on your opinion. So these are the ones that have come out sort of in the last month or so. Brett, unfortunately, hasn't got a chance to read a couple of these, but everybody else has, and Brett will weigh in on what he has had a chance to read. So let's get the number one, though, that came out this week out of the way, and that would have been Mondo, number or Mongo? Mongo or
Mondo?
Pardon me?
Mondo.
Mondo.
Mondo. Okay, it is Mondo. Ted McKeever's Mondo from Image, number one. Brett, what did you think of this one?
Well, really, any book that involves mutant, chickens, and men combining gets my vote pretty much at any time. It was psychotically weird, which I've pretty much come to expect out of Ted McKeever. I note that his art style has actually... it's actually matured a little bit. There are characters in there that start to share a resemblance to humans. but you know, the trademark McKeever is still there. And, you know, it's just so completely out of left field that I had no idea where it was going to go. And I'm pretty glad of that. And I would totally keep reading this book because it's just psychotic. It makes me feel weird.
Chris, what do you think?
I have a difficult relationship with Ted McKeever. I always buy his books, read them, and look at them and go, I have no idea what happened. Yet, when the next one comes out, I buy it. I guarantee you, next week, when I'm eating a Kentucky Fried Chicken, I'm going to feel a little sick. Not just because of the KFC, but because of their portrayal of chickens. Something about his art just gets in my head.
We'll be eating at the KFC regardless.
It's KFC, man. They got good gravy.
I love the gravy.
Yeah. But that's beside the point. I never actually enjoy reading the book, but I enjoy thinking about the book afterwards. And that's true with all his work. It just gets in my head and plays with me. It's unlike any other comic book experience I've ever had.
Sounds like you should give it 50
bucks. Gets in there and plays with me.
Sounds like you should give it 50 bucks for playing with you.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Yeah, no, just his ideas are so bizarre, and I mean, there's no real narrative to speak of. It's just, I mean, some of the bad guys don't even have faces because you can tell he just got bored of drawing them.
Keith, what do you think?
I actually think Chris is onto something there. I have that experience with a lot of McKeever work. I was drawn to his work a long time ago with, you know, work like Metropol and Plastic Force because it was just so, so different. You know, it's like David Lynch with art by Keith Giffen. It's very, like, very abstract, very, you know, rough pen and ink work. I never have any idea what's going on in a Ted McKeever book, but I also have a collection of them. I even got a couple of the hardcover collections that have come out of his earlier work. I'll probably keep going, even though I have no idea what's going on in this book.
As Brett is showing me right now some of his artwork from him that he's gotten signed. Nice. That's cool. Yeah, you know what? This was so innovative and original and insane in his art style. But, I mean, I love the book. I have no idea what – it's too bad all of you have said this because I sound like I have no idea what the hell is going on in this book. And you got – yeah, I have no idea what the hell is going on in this book. But I sure enjoyed reading it. I can't really tell you, say anything else. This is not for everybody. And yet all four of us enjoyed reading it, so just or to some degree, or have some enjoyment from it. So that's saying something.
We got to that
end. Is the chick with the big eyes associated with anyone in this book?
No idea, because I didn't know what was going on anyway. She's just a character shows up, rips somebody's arm off, feeds it to them, and then we don't see her again. But that's okay, because we literally had a radioactive chicken chasing a guy down an alley. It was awesome, though I had no idea what was going on.
And I didn't care. I didn't want to know what was going on. I just wanted radioactive chickens, mutant chickens, and stuff like that. That was really all I wanted. And I thought, hey, let's revel in the fact that
you'd have no idea that it's going to have mutant chickens from the title, from the cover, from any of that. And yet, when mutant chickens showed up, I went, bonus.
Did anyone laugh extremely hard when the landlady showed up?
Oh, yeah.
And complained he wasn't making noise?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was too awesome. Quiet. Hey, Chris, did you read this and go, God, I got to watch Poltergeist again? I did.
Oh, you know what? I didn't, but that would be an awesome duper.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, if you haven't seen Thanksgiving as well, talking turkey that kills people, oh.
Oh, I'm right on that, baby. Tonight, as soon as this is over, I'm watching me some Thanksgiving. It's got to be somewhere.
I got to the end of this book and it had the, you know, next time in Mondo. And I'm like, what good is this to me? I don't know what happened last time in Mondo.
This was something else, this book. Chris, why don't you talk about the first of our miniseries that we're going to get to here. That's the Penguin. What is it? Penguin Pain and Prejudice was the name of this miniseries.
You know what? My review is going to be short on this. It was probably passable. I've been reading it for a while. I didn't read it all in one go like you guys did. And each issue, I didn't feel ripped off or anything like that. But if I was going to do it again, I probably wouldn't. It was a fairly remarkable, generic Batman miniseries. I will say that I like the Penguin as sort of more of a businessman character than an actual villain that fights Batman directly. I just didn't care.
Keith, what do you think of it?
I really like the art on this book, and the name of the artist has completely gone out of my mind, though. I actually had read the first one when it came out and then put the whole thing aside to read as a miniseries, which I often do. And I really liked it, and I don't want to spoiler it, but I liked it until the last issue. I thought it really fell off in the final issue. And I thought that it tied it up a little too neatly. I liked what they developed. They really did this proper introduction of the Penguin from the New 52, who is the more gang leader, that, you know, the gangster type, kind of Kingpin-ish. And they have been teasing that for a while in the Bat books, but really solidifying it here. Playing with this idea that he's, you know, Batman can rough him up, but he hasn't really broken any laws that Batman can pin on him yet. And I like all that. But yeah, it just, the fifth issue, I think, drops off and it wraps it up in a too tidy a package. I would have preferred that they kind of leave the character a little less settled than he is at the end of the miniseries. Overall, I really did like it, though.
Now here's something. Now, Brett didn't read this miniseries, and I'm not sure if he will or won't, but I am going to ask this question about this as we talk about it. Because there's two characterizations that are common of the Penguin, and you don't really know which one you're going to get. And that is the high society Penguin. Well, three, actually, really. There's kind of the campy, regular villain Penguin that you would think of from the 60s Batman TV show and such. But he was just around the comic books at the time. He's just a regular – he was a villain, a little bit campy. Then you had the kind of high society character. Mob boss, kind of a high society character. And then you have the third characterization, which is basically the Danny DeVito dark, twisted character. You know, a monster physically, whereas the high society one is a guy short and a little bit rotund, but high society kind of well-mannered guy, even though he's a villain. Like, this one was that monster, Danny DeVito. That's the take in this miniseries. And you don't know what you're going to get. I mean, it's just because we say this is the continuity of the new 52, next time we see him, he could be the high society one. Because they've done this back and forth without any context between the series. It's just basically up to the idea of the writers. But what's your favorite way to see the Penguin character done, Brett?
I think for myself, I prefer the high society one. I like the element that he brings, you know, just something a little more suave to being the fat character, as opposed to like just being yet another, you know, troll-like character in Batman's rogues gallery.
Keith, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I like the character darker and, you know, threatening, but at the same time, you know, they've had an era of Batman comics. Particularly kind of the late 80s as they reintroduced characters after Crisis, that all of them kind of hit the same notes. You know, Two-Face, Penguin, Joker, Riddler, all of them kind of hit the, you know, I'm going to kill a room full of people so that you know that he's a dark character and the stakes are higher kind of stuff. But there wasn't enough differentiation. And, you know, the old gimmicky stuff was different, but that's not the Batman that's around. It hasn't been around in a long time. You know, the more gimmicky, you know, umbrellas that he could fly with and that kind of thing. It hasn't been around in quite a long time. So yeah, I like something that makes him a different type of character from, you know, the other members of Batman's Rogues Gallery.
You, Chris, what do you prefer?
Definitely the high society. I love the Penguin in high society. My favorite portrayal of him was in Batman No Man's Land, where he wasn't really a bad guy. He was just a facilitator that cross the moral line.
Yeah, I like that portrayal as well. And I agree. All of us like the high society guy. Like I say, this is the Danny DeVito-inspired monster character, really, in this one.
Definitely. That's what I didn't like about it, is that he was just a little too crazy.
Yeah, that's what I didn't like about
it. Penguin should be the same villain in Batman's Gallery.
Yeah, he wasn't. He generally is one of the more sane. He's a villain, but he's one of the more sane characters. This character is not sane really at all. He's twisted. And like I say, I just think, to me, this didn't really work. I don't think this is a good, this is not the Penguin that I want to read. I didn't really like being in this guy's world as much. I didn't like the, I thought there was a lot of, like, the issue, like, the issue, there's a love interest character. I thought they were stretching things with her portrayal and her interaction with the Joker character a lot. I thought the art, while being very nice, I thought it was a little bit too heavy on the inks and a little bit too dark. So some of the subtleties of what they're trying to portray didn't come across to me. I think that Batman in this, you know, we see several weeks go by and some really, really terrible things done by this Penguin character that he can't connect. Batman isn't in this too much, but instead of being the world's greatest detective in this, the fact that he can't put together all these events that are occurring more quickly makes him seem like the world's shittiest detective. I don't think it's really a poor quality book. I just know it really, I had issues with it and it didn't work for me. Keith, now that we've said all that, since you're the one who liked it, do you have any rebuttal?
No, I just dug it. I did like the art style. Yeah, I mean, I get where you're going with the Batman, and you know, it is telling though that it's not Batman, Penguin, Pain and Prejudice. It's Penguin.
I'm going to say this then. I'll say, Keith, you read these, and often we give you books to read, and you have to go on and read them. I would love it if you would, because I know you build up nothing. The worst part of the show for Keith is the fact that his back issue bin has been growing at a phenomenal rate since this has come up. But I hope you have time for this, because I would love to get your opinion. I think that the better introduction for this character still comes from two books. Number one, the slightly better in this, not phenomenally better, but a little bit better in this, The Killing Peck by Alan Grant and Norm Breyfogle. That was kind of the post-crisis return of the character and what he did with it. So I'll say this. And the fantastic, this is the way where you saw this character, because you saw this character in this miniseries from a youth, and what made him into a villain, the one that shows him from a youth and makes him into a villain that I would recommend is John Ostrander and the fantastic Joe Staton's, I think it's called Penguin the Triumph, if I remember correctly. And I'll look that up for you a little bit later, but just to make sure. But I'm sure you can find it based on Ostrander and Staton. But Penguin Triumphant is what I believe it's called. And it came out about the time of the movie, because they were doing these graphic novel prestige format introductions.
Oh, I think I've read that. I think I've read that one.
Yeah, that to me is way better than this. And I would – anybody who's reading this and going, yeah, it's good or it's not good – go seek that sucker out, because I think that's fantastic, and that's the Penguin character you should read, an introduction to the character, I believe. So, all right, let's move on to Severed, a book that I thought was tremendous, miniseries by Scott Snyder. And anybody else remember the other two creators? There was another co-plotter, writer, and the artist, and for the life of me, I cannot think of them. But anybody have those off?
Didn't know there was going to be a quiz.
Yeah, unfortunately, everybody just kind of goes, Snyder, we know him, we love him. And but everybody else did a good job in this book as well. I thought this book was tremendous. Another winner from Image. I'm not saying that Image never does anything wrong. I'm just saying I haven't read anything they're doing wrong for a long, long time. Everything seems to come out right. This was awesome, I thought. I think there's now – I've heard Chris has given a hint that he's not as high on it. But I thought just for characterization, dialogue, pacing, art – I think this is as good as comics get. My only issue I had with it is that this is a horror book where it tries to ramp up the horror as it goes on. But unfortunately, in the prologue, you kind of tell us you give away what's happened with the character. So to me, the horror, it's tough to be as horrified and worried for the character when you see him in the future and you kind of already know what's happened. You know, the story's how to get there. But I think what they're trying to do was build a lot of tension about the danger of the universe, and you don't feel this as dangerous or scary when you know where the character is already going to be when he's an adult, but because as a character, it's a 12-year-old boy, his story. So we'll go with Keith, and then I'll let Chris give his final thoughts on it.
Well, Scott Snyder's relationship with Stephen King is very evident in this story. It's very much structured the way a King short story is. I enjoyed it. I'm not sure it's the right length, I'll be honest. It kind of feels like maybe it's an issue longer than it should have been.
I wanted to say that about Penguin. I thought that would have been good as a 48-page one-shot instead of a 5-issue series. Sometimes you're right. Sometimes getting these miniseries at the right amount of issues is maybe difficult.
Yeah, and for two that are 5 and 7, which are less common than a 4 or 6 these days, there must have been some kind of very specific choice to size them that way. No one ever offers, it had to be 7 issues because of this. Maybe someday we'll have Scott Snyder on and we can ask why 7.
Make the interview request.
I enjoyed the series and I do like the twists and turns. I like the self-contained nature of it. Sometimes it's nice to read a story that, isn't trying to create sequels for itself or anything like that. It does have that creepy feel to it, like a good old Stephen King short story. So, I'd recommend this one. And quite enjoyed it.
Yeah. Do you think there was a mistake, though, in giving us that prologue, seeing the character in the future? That's my only problem with this. I'm actually curious.
See, I'd actually forgotten the prologue by the time you get to the twist, but it took a bit away because instead of expecting it, it happens, and then I'm like, oh yeah, that thing from the beginning. Instead of expecting it, I just had a moment of anticlimax where I'm just, oh yeah, the thing, they mentioned that.
All right, Brett, unfortunately he hasn't got to this one. This is one I hope he does read, unlike Penguin. Chris, your thoughts?
It's interesting that Keith actually mentioned Stephen King, another writer I don't particularly enjoy. I'm not saying this is a low-quality book because it's high quality. I think the story is interesting. The art is beautiful. But I had some serious problems, with number one, the length. And number two, the villain of this piece. I never quite understood his motivation. A good villain, in my estimation, is a hero in his own story. And that wasn't taking place. I would have been much more interested to see the two boys, I'm using the air quotes that are so affected on radio, hoboing. I thought that would have been a much more interesting story than to involve what turns out to be the villain. I just didn't buy the whole Jeopardy angle. It just didn't work for me.
Any response to that, Keith? Because I know I do. I'll give you an opportunity if you have anything to say there.
Yeah, I'd say if you don't like Stephen King's style or Stephen King's work, because that to me was the most Stephen King part of this was the antagonist in the story. It was very much, Stephen King always uses the. I can't remember what his phrase, but it's the mundane. It's the everyday that he wants to be scary. It's the clown at the party, from It. It's the creepy hotel. It's not necessarily demons from hell. It's some everyday thing that becomes the enemy. And that's the kind of villain that, you see off all the time in Stephen King. But if you don't like Stephen King, then, it doesn't. Then that comparison is not going to sell you, that's for sure.
And now that we mentioned Stephen King, you named the Bates Motel. Did you say that?
The Overlook was his hotel.
Oh, the Overlook was his hotel.
From The Shining.
You didn't find the relationship between the Penguin and his mother kind of like Norman Bates and his mother? Not to go back to that too much. Keith, or Chris, you know what, Chris? I think you're generally right. I think generally I do prefer to know the villain's story, and like you say, he should be a hero in his own mind, but not every time. I mean, I think that's better for more important for a character like a Doctor Doom, who you're going to see over 400 issues showing up every now and then. He needs to be drawn out like that. He needs to have that background. In a 6 or 7 issue miniseries, I don't know if that's as important. Michael Myers in the Halloween movie, you had no idea his background. He was just the boogeyman, and he was just evil and scary, and that's what this character is. I don't need to know his background or why. He's a killer. He eats boys. He's a cannibal, and he likes to play with them first mentally. He enjoys that, and that's just evil, and that's just something that people could fall into. And there are those characters do exist in their own way. And just because he thinks this, he's a predator. A predator never thinks that he's in the wrong. He's proud of that. So I don't really necessarily agree with that point of view, though I think I do understand where you're coming from.
Yeah, no, as I said, it's a high quality book. It was just a little dry, and I wanted a little more meat on the bone.
Well, I mean, you can have
that's
the
basically all I'm saying.
You can have the two. You can have the two looks. You can have the Michael Myers, who's just the boogeyman, or you can have the Rob Zombie Michael Myers, who comes from an abusive household, who's you can understand his psychology, and you can prefer one character over the other. For the Halloween movies, I think the original Michael Myers is more effective, and I think that's what this character is here. But I do understand your point of view. All right, let's move on to our last book of the week. And here we're going to go off to Brett because he read it.
Yes.
Magneto, Not a Hero.
I read the first issue, and I actually was kind of excited. I thought that, you know, granted it's the kind of character, the Magneto character that we're used to seeing, I think, but I was interested in it. I thought, hey, this is good. Maybe they're going to really, like, delve some more into the character, especially as the new elements are happening in the X universe. And so I thought, okay, interesting. Then I read issue 2 and 3, and I thought, well, I guess they're not going to delve into the character. I guess they're just going to have a fight scene. And then I read issue 4, and it all wrapped up. And I thought to myself, well, that's unfortunate. I didn't get anything that I wanted. This is a prime book for me that could have been told in 2 issues. There was nowhere near enough story to support 4 issues in my mind. I wanted to like it, but I really didn't. And the art style, well, passable. It was pedestrian, you know, and there was things that annoyed me about it. The writing was, again, pretty much pedestrian. It was every time I want to like something from either Marvel or DC that's a character that I really do like, they put people on it that give me these books that are just pedestrian. And Magneto is completely average. And at the end of it, I'm like, no, I couldn't see myself reading that ever again.
Oh, I'm going to go next here on this one. I'm not as familiar with the current Marvel Universe. I've been reading really the last few years since Avengers Disassembled, because I kind of got turned off by the numerous large story arcs and crossovers and such. It became too much for me.
That's right, because DC was a lot better.
Well, but DC was better for me in that it had more characters I was familiar with, so I could follow that a little easier. Because one thing I've never really followed too much is the X books. I've read a lot of Marvel, but the X books have just never been something I've gravitated towards. I've been Spider-Man, largely, and actually basically Spider-Man and Power Man and Iron Fist, but but no, I mean, the X books were never something I was big into. And I found a lot of characters thrown at me in this miniseries without any explanation of who they are. Too much assumption again that we know who these characters are. And any more storylines where a character is up against his clone, I don't want to have anything to do with. I think that this is a problem that comes across. It comes across. It's a lot of Marvel, but it's especially prevalent to me in the X books. All of the X books, and this is a problem with I have right now. We always kind of go, "Hey, Image, that was surprisingly good," and Marvel or DC, "Boy, that was disappointing." And I think this is a problem, like I say, especially in Marvel, and especially in the X books. And that's that their characters just aren't overly likable. They don't have a lot of characters that are likable. There's nobody who nobody who I could really gravitate towards or cheer towards here in this book. Magneto, Not a Hero. Well, okay, I guess you weren't, but, you know, I found this boring. It didn't work for me at all.
Sorry, my review is Magneto, Not a Story.
Yeah, not a good job pulling me in. Chris, what do you think?
I loved it. I'm a huge fan of the Joseph character, who has a major role in this miniseries. I collected his own series when it was written by Peter Milligan in the 90s. I especially enjoyed the art, actually. I thought Clay Mann, who I've never actually seen his work before, his perspectives were great. I felt like I was watching Cloverfield or something. It almost had that shaky cam found footage feel to it. Really enjoyed that. The writing wasn't quite as strong, and I did look up the writer. And I couldn't actually find anything he's ever written before. He's primarily an artist on a series like the Marvel Oz series and a couple manga things for Marvel. The writing was definitely weaker than I would have liked, but I really did enjoy the art.
Keith.
I'd definitely read it again.
All right, Keith, what's your thoughts?
Like many miniseries, I read the first issue to see if I wanted to continue with it, and then I put them aside to read them all. So when this was coming up and I knew it was ending, I said, this one, we've got to read this one, because that was one of the best number ones I've read in a long time. And, you know, it's just as I was getting back, trying to get back into the X titles with Schism, I read that. I'm like, actually, if this is what Avengers versus X-Men is going to be like, that scene with Cyclops, Magneto, and Captain America and Iron Man that's in issue one, I'm like, I'm in if it's like that, because that was a really cool scene. And then the other three issues happen. And they bring back in Joseph, who, you know, I remember Joseph from the 1990s when I did collect the X-Books. I collected them through about the mid-90s. And I never knew what happened to that character. And I'm not sure that the writer of this miniseries did either. It's never really addressed other than they think he's dead. But, you know, there's no fill-in of, you know, how they ever wrapped up that storyline. I don't even know where they wrapped it up. I guess I've got to hit the Wikipedia now. And the whole purpose of the miniseries, as opposed to what I thought I was going to be getting of really unpacking who Magneto is now and how he relates to Cyclops, which is what we saw in the first issue, the whole point of the miniseries really seemed to be reintroducing Joseph to the current Marvel Universe. That doesn't get me anywhere, though. We didn't need that character. And he hasn't been around in who knows how long, and no one else has been looking for him. Yeah, it wasn't the story I had hoped it would be from the first issue. So I'd say the first issue, didn't have a little bit of a cliffhanger, because I just tossed issues 2 through 4 and pretend it was only a one-shot.
Anybody else want to address the likability of characters within Marvel, especially X-Books? Am I off on this?
Well, yeah, but it's Magneto, though, so he's never been a terrible
It's all the
characters
I'm saying. It's not just him. This is my problem. I mean, I don't find anybody likable.
Well, yeah, I mean, when you look at it, I mean, you look at, okay, Emma Frost, she's got her moments of not likable. Cyclops certainly is becoming a not likable character. Wolverine has his moments of not likable. Yeah, you know, I mean, there is characters I like. I've always liked Kitty Pryde.
I thought Cyclops has really developed into a more complex character over the past few months.
I love the new Cyclops. Like, I love the way the character is. I'm just saying, like, from most perspective, I can see how you could class him as not likable.
What about within the rest of the Marvel Universe? You find this a problem? Is it just me?
I think Peter Parker's likable. I think they've added a lot of darkness.
He's as likable as he used to be.
I think they've added a lot of darkness to the Marvel books over the past few years, you know, particularly coming out of House of M and, you know, Disassembled, and then Civil War. It's just become a really dark universe, and there aren't a lot of bright spots. We do have, you know, the new Daredevil, for example, is a lighter character. Venom, which I've been loving except for this little crossover thingy the event that's happening right now. But he's a troubled character for sure, but he is a very heroic character. So yeah, I mean, I point to those kinds of characters, but I think that just overall Marvel has gone to kind of a dark place, and, you know, DC went there too for a long time, but has now kind of come out of it. And I think they need to come out, that Marvel needs to come out of this.
This is kind of what I'm hoping for a reboot could do. If they did it, maybe they can make some more refresh some of these characters and make them more likable for me.
Well, look at Daredevil. I mean, Daredevil is a great example of how...
You know what he is, and I do enjoy that book.
Yeah, exactly. You took a character that was very dark, and then you made him light and the way he used to be, and, you know, we all pretty much enjoyed the book.
I heard someone say on another podcast that...
There is no other podcast. You know,
there are lesser podcasts. They've introduced Black Cat as a love interest for Daredevil. But is it going to work if she can't die or go insane?
Yeah, no kidding.
That's his type.
All right. Well, any last thoughts on anything this week? Then let's go to the plugs, Brett.
All right. Fair enough. Well, once again, just to clear this off, Brett_WeTalk, Brett@WeTalkPodcast.com. Let's see now. We just talked to Lacuna Coil over the weekend. They're a metal band that's been around for a while, and they're going to be coming up on a podcast soon. And then I'm just going to throw a little shout-out to my buddy Comic Canuck and his website, ComicCanuck.com, and, of course, Comic Therapy. Check it out. It's good stuff.
Keith.
I am Cub Reporter K on Twitter. And you can email me at keith@wetalkpodcast.com. And I finally finished reading New Krypton after years of putting it off and not liking the whole concept. And it was not really that great. I really liked the way it started, and then the Nightwing and Flamebird thing just dragged down the whole storyline. And someone joked on my Twitter that they enjoyed 700 out of the 1,000 parts of that story, and that's kind of what it felt like. Every time I opened a new one that was Flamebird and Nightwing, I just thought, oh, you two again. So I'm happy to finally, I now have read it. If I reread it, I will skip about half the books that were in it. It was a bit of a slog to get through that whole stack.
Chris, your turn.
I'm Chris at WeTalkPodcast.com. You can follow me at Twitter at Chris_WeTalk. And I just finished reading the entire run of the Thunderbolts. And I have to say, for 170 issues, it holds up amazingly well. For the number of cast changes they made, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of continuity errors or anything like that. Truly enjoyed it.
All right, cool. I'm Mo, M-O. At WeTalkPodcast.com and Mo_WeTalk once again on Twitter. We got, as Brett mentions, he has some podcasts, music podcasts coming up. We have a lot of other concepts coming up. And of course, the most popular sports podcast on Podomatic by Landslide. We talk wrestling. We just put up an episode where we did live commentary while watching a WWE Raw, and audio quality is crap, but holy shit, is this funny. Mystery Science Theater 3000 fans, check this one out. And other than that, we got a book sent to us, a preview from Comics Tribe again. They're really, really good to us. And they sent us a book, The Red 10, number 2, which is coming out, I believe, is it the end of this month, Keith? Do you recall? It is correct.
Should be the 29th.
The 29th, I thought so. It's just tremendous. What an excellent story. The art is continuing to improve. They added an inker who helps flesh out the art terrifically. This is what I like about Comics Tribe is anybody who has ideas on what an independent book is, throw that out the window, because Comics Tribe, as far as the quality of their craftsmanship, both from a storyline as well as a production and value from simply from the layout and the art and the paper and all that stuff, it's as good as anything at a major publisher. So it's not an independent book from that perspective. It's only independent from the fact they're a new company that doesn't yet have the name recognition. But yeah, I absolutely recommend it. It's awesome. So, you know, if you have an opportunity to pick up the Red 10 number 2 or order a PDF from Drive-Thru Comics or another site, I would absolutely recommend that. We do have on our site a way to get to some books and support the show if you enjoy us. And I'll let Brett just quickly go through that.
Yeah, if you go to the WeTalk podcast, I almost, geez, I'm going to follow Chris, but if you go to WeTalkPodcast.com and you go to the links section, then actually there's some previews of both Scam number one and Red 10 number one, as well as a link to get you to the Comics Tribe web store.
All right, and yeah, and if you want to support them, absolutely recommend it. You can find them through us. So, yeah, WeTalkPodcast.com, the place to go for all our crap. And, hey, it's a lot of it. A lot of it's good shit. So those of you who like good shit or our crap, that's where it is. OUT.